We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Like that? Whistle ready.
Thank you for coming back to the Quick Restart Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined as always by Clint Kosnick. And Clint, while this is the podcast that we look forward to doing every year and were deprived of it last year, there is also that small tinge of, man, we're closing the book on the 2021 season. Congratulations to Lars Tiffany and the Virginia Cavaliers as they once again emerge national champions with an incredible final game performance against the Maryland Terrapins, emerging 17-16 victors. You were on the call. What did you think of Monday's action?
Oh, it was fun. It was pretty cool. You know, usually I'm kind of down after the season ends this year. That's not the case. I don't know why. I'm actually a little upbeat considering, you know, you look back and we actually got the season in. You know, good morning. Welcome back to we head forward to 2022. Welcome back, Ivy League. We missed you. We love you. You're back in the mix. But yesterday was all about – yesterday was – like it's very rare that I have a score sheet from the championship that I'm on two pages here. You know, I got through my first page and it's 13-11 and my second page takes it down to the final of 17-16. So that kind of goal total, we talked about the shot clock for a decade and a half. I mean, Eamon used to sit on a soapbox and I chimed in and gosh, you know, we always thought the game had so much more in that stall ball era. And here we are now, we've played three of the last four championship games. It's just these playoff games in the shot clock era have been just incredible. So, you know, tip of the cap to everybody who made it through this season. You know, all those teams played in their league tournaments. Those who didn't. Those who advanced. An incredible year for these young student athletes and the coaches and the administrations. And you know, to see those teams shake hands at the end of that game yesterday was pretty powerful to me.
That was a very cool moment, particularly after during the broadcast you commented on how you felt like the sportsmanship had never been higher, and yet the tensions were also incredibly high in the midst of that championship game, with Paul talking about both benches barking at one another. But let's talk about the way in which the game unfolded. It was slow to start. It took almost 8 minutes for the first goal to be scored, and then it took about 8 seconds for the second goal to be scored as Virginia managed to keep pace with Maryland's more efficient 6-on-6 offense in the first quarter by getting 2 goals off of a faceoff and 1 goal off of an Ian Laviano rideback. So Petey LaSala ended the first quarter with a goal and an assist, and the game was 4-4, despite the fact that Virginia went 1-of-7 on their settled 6-on-6 possessions. And in my estimation, Maryland looked like the team better situated for sustained success throughout the game.
After one quarter, I would agree with you. In this game, you know, DraftKings had the line. I liked Virginia getting the what was it, 2 goals, and I actually
it
thought
settled
the under
at 1.5.
Was what? Okay.
So yeah,
well,
getting
I
2 goals.
Virginia. I liked Virginia to win an 11-10 game, and somewhere late in the first quarter, I kind of looked at myself and said, "I don't think this is going to be 11-10," because the pace of scoring there in the second portion of the first quarter was with the 2 faceoff goals and the ride goal, you know, Virginia kind of showed their pace. I thought the 2 failed clears by Maryland early were important. Again, teams were gauging. The slide mentality in playoff games is so critical to understand. What I've noticed in recent years is teams are less likely to slide the further you get in the playoffs. It's amazing how during the regular season we see these schemes where teams are flying and sliding to everything. And as teams get better and better and better, they have more weapons. They don't want to get beat by ball movement and players, you know, shooting with their feet set off of rapid ball movement where your goalie is moving from side to side and his head is on a swivel. So more inclined to leave their guys on an island. They're very good defenders. They wouldn't be playing in this game if they weren't good. And so it's kind of like, well, we trust our guy. Let's simplify things. And so that's a trend that I'm seeing in the last 3 to 4 years in national championship and semifinal type games is, you know, less complex defensive schemes. Keep it simple. Stay home. Cover your guy. If he gets beat, our goalie's going to make the stop.
And to that extent, it's important to talk about the matchups at the Maryland offensive end. Cade Sostad drew Jared Bernhardt and put in a yeoman's effort, and Kyle Kaloji guarded Logan Wisnoskis. And at the other end of the field, Nick Grill was matched up against Connor Schellenberger, and Brett Makar was matched up against Matt Moore. Jared Bernhardt, the presumptive Twerton winner, most of his production came early. He had two assists in the first quarter and then two goals back-to-back in the second quarter. And from that point on, I thought, particularly in the third, and we'll get to this in a second, but when Maryland fell behind, he wasn't initiating very much, and I thought that the Terps' game plan was to save him for the fourth quarter. In retrospect, it looks like Saucehead just had a really, really good day.
Yeah, I think when you look at this, the ebb and flow of this game, there's two Virginia runs, okay? Maryland led 4-2. Virginia then led 8-4, so that's a six-goal run. Many unassisted goals in that run. Connor, Schellenberger, Connor, unassisted, unassisted, unassisted. Maryland fights back. You know, they score, what, three in a row, halftime 9-7, Virginia. And then there's a run, really the deciding run in this game, I thought, was Wisnoskis ties it with his fourth of the game. 11 all in the third quarter.
It's still early in the third quarter.
There was
9 minutes and 11 seconds.
Was Garneau, Schellenberger unassisted on the inside roll. Moore, I believe, unassisted for the 14th. Yep. Schellenberger unassisted for the 15th. And then Moore from Connor with about, 11 minutes to go. They led 16-11. So that's the deciding salvo, so to speak. Prior to what played out before. That set the table for obviously the conclusion of this game. I thought Virginia may have slowed it down maybe a tad. I would say maybe a minute too early, one possession too early. I thought they went to their stall ball. But if you look at the clock and score and you do the 80 seconds and how many possessions we need. But I give Maryland credit late in that game, Terry, because I thought that they made a decision, hey, this may blow up in our face and we may lose by 12, but it's a national championship game, so we got to start chasing now. And they started chasing maybe a little earlier than we're used to seeing in the regular season, and I loved it. I loved it. Like, if we're going to win this game, we got to change it now. 10-man ride, pressing here, pressing there, and that did trigger change, and they were able to score three quick goals in a minute. So they deserve a lot of credit for that.
Absolutely. It is now officially Maverick May Madness on InsideLacrosse.com, and the new Maverick EKG shoulder pads and chest protector are here for all players. Get upgraded performance protection that meets the new Noxy safety standards. Shop the whole line on lax.com/EKG. My task on Monday was writing the "Why did Virginia win the game?" story, and my immediate reaction is because the simple answer, Alex Rode made a game-saving save with about 4 seconds left that would have, if it had gone in, tied the game and sent it to overtime. But that's a simple answer. The more complex answer is that I think Virginia won this game in three ways or moments, and we've already touched on two of them. I think the transition, the way in which they exploited Maryland in transition in the first quarter prevented them from falling into a hole. I think the feet set shooting and some of the unassisted goals that you talked about during that five-goal run to turn an 11-11 game into a 16-11 game, that ultimately determined the outcome. But I really think that the kind of insurance goal that came off of a – so Maryland scores on an Anthony DeMeo unassisted goal with 3:57 left. And then on the subsequent faceoff, Petey LaSala wins it back, and as part of the clear – Saucehead throws the ball to Jack Peel in the middle of the field. In an effort to get the ball back, Maryland brings him down, draws a flag. Peel loses the ball. Saucehead jumps over the scrum of bodies, picks up the ground ball, and has daylight. He streaks forward. He finds Matt Moore on the backside of the crease for an easy finish. It was a push, so the flag got waved off, but it put Virginia up 17-15 with 3:35 to go. And that play... That is one of those plays that I think is going to get a little bit lost to history that ultimately, without, Virginia doesn't win this game in my estimation.
Yeah, no, it's not lost in my history. You know, interesting point you make about the feet set shooting and making guys shoot on the run from your anonymous scouting reports. It was interesting because I was getting the same text from High Point's John Torpy, and the commentary kind of matched up. So I was wondering if John Torpy is one of your anonymous scouting report, guys, Terry.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. You know, you go through the personnel, and I got my boards open right now, and you look like, where was this game won or lost? I mean, the fact that Virginia has Schellenberger and Moore is greater than Jared Vernhardt, one guy. Wisnauskas did his job. Maltz was a little quiet, although I thought he played a pretty good game. Maryland got complimentary scoring. You know, the Griffin Browns and Eric Holden and Maliver, I think, did enough. Geppert was good in the middle of the field. And I think at the end of the day, I got to go back and look at the defense, because I think that's where this game is probably hidden, won and lost. Some of the slide decisions that were made or not made, some of the pick defense that was good or gave guys dodging edges. Schellenberger did real good work off of some picks that just gave him a slight edge on Grill, maybe forced Grill to chase and he didn't get upfield. You know, one thing we saw in the playoffs was defenders trailing a right-handed curl dodge, let's say, you know, instead of using a V-hold and giving up some relatively easy shots. That's a technique thing that we probably have to discuss with somebody like a Jerry Byrne, who's anonymously texting me throughout a game of this magnitude.
That doesn't bother you at all when you're trying to focus on the action on the field.
Neither goalie played great. You know, Maryland misses a guy like Jake Higgins in a game like this, flat out. Like, you know, I played in a national title game without a starting defender, and that without our number one LSM. And, like, those injuries early in the year, in a game like this, they come back to haunt you. You know, Virginia was playing without Danny Parker all season long, and you got to give Merle. I thought Chris Merle really improved a ton. Grayson Soliday with his great semifinal game. Fox is steady as a rock. And they got some great minutes out of Jack Peel. So that's like those guys are got to be Lars Tiffany's MVPs. Development of Jared Connors continued to get better as the season progressed, as did Cade Sostad. And then what can you say about, you know, Cole Kastner becoming a starter and a primetime stopper? So pretty cool. Pretty cool game. A lot of goals, a lot of excitement. It's going to be replayed on Tuesday, probably by the time this podcast airs, Tuesday afternoon on ESPNU. I would look out for the ACC Network. I wouldn't be surprised if they did something special with this game and some Virginia players or coaches.
One more sequence we've got to talk about is with about 2:15 left to go, Virginia got a flag in the Maryland defensive end. There was an opportunity to throw the ball out of bounds, get a free clear, and run your extra man down to. There's a, I don't want to call it a controversy.
Yeah.
It's a conversation
it's clock and score management with a flag down. What do you do? You know, I got a text from a pretty well-known official saying Maryland should have thrown that out of bounds right away. I'm like, well, you got Bernhardt, you got a free play. Like, that's not a bad opportunity. I just thought that they were a little too casual, that they were a little too slow in trying that last attempt with the flag down, because it's a free play. So don't you like the thought of a free play, jamming the ball inside to a guy or going on a dive bombing dodge? Isn't that an opportunity? Isn't that a freebie that you probably should take? But if clearing, you know, would they lose 38 seconds in the interim?
It was 38 seconds from the save to when the extra man ultimately started.
Yeah. And we can talk. I know what you want to talk about next. What I want to talk about next is that final faceoff, because that final faceoff reminded me just so much of the 2005 semifinal between, was it five or seven? Five.
Are you talking about Virginia,
Virginia
Hopkins?
Semifinals.
Yeah.
Virginia Hopkins. Same exact scenario, different tactics. Bernhardt on the wing. Well, Connors at the last minute realizes Bernhardt's on the wing and he flips sides. So he's worried about Bernhardt. So the pole's not getting to the hole to stop the fast break. The shorty's on the other side for Virginia. Why he didn't take a defensive posture, I don't know. That was a colossal failure in scheme by Virginia's wings on that faceoff. Plus, Petey LaSala, with 10.8 to go, he's got to go down the line. He's got to prevent the out the front. Even concede possession, but make Maryland go back. Again, like mind-boggling, like how that happened. The one thing that can't happen did, and then they slow played the break. Bernhardt's not at the point. Remember, he's on the wing, so I'm not even sure who the righty point man was. Next thing you know, Wehrman comes in to seven and hits Rode Rode really had no chance if that ball was you know on the fringes of the goal, but the kid made the save. Give him a ton of credit. He's got two rings, but the tactics of that last faceoff could be analyzed for hours.
So one thing that I saw on Twitter after the game was the notion of going early to concede the faceoff and then dropping back and getting into a set defense. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, if Maryland has a timeout, that's probably not the move to do. I think Maryland had exhausted their timeouts. So you know, you go early, I think they can call a timeout on that dead ball, I believe.
I believe that's right.
Yeah, but if they're out of timeouts, then their pieces are out of place. They got Bernhardt up on a wing. They got Kyle Long up on a wing. They got a Fogo with the ball. So what's going to happen there? The Fogo is going to drop the ball. Jared's going to run over and take it. So do you like those chances? Jared Bernhardt with open space, 10 seconds to go?
But, like, but you're playing not an five ideal on six. Scenario
if you're Virginia. Well, you got to respect Wehrman if he runs down to the crease. He's got to be covered.
Yeah.
And at that stage, he should stay on the field. So that's a viable strategy. Yes, that's an opportunity. You know, intentionally violate and drop. Going back to 205, I thought Virginia messed it up. Virginia should have won the faceoff, and they forced Hopkins to go back. But the personnel, the way they had their poles and their shorties, wasn't smart. You know, where do you put your poles and your shorties defensively? Do you double pull the wings? Again, posture is so important. You can concede the faceoff. I don't understand why that other player is running hip to hip instead of getting to the hole and taking away transition. Or you just beats him. Or maybe it just beats him because it's a straight line. It just beats him there. And then that in my eyes comes back on the Fogo, because that's the one thing you can't let the guy do is get out the front quickly. And if he does get out the front, just tackle him. And take the violation for a stoppage. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So if he's beating me front, I'm just going to stick my foot out and trip the guy, tackle him, hold him, do something, hook him. And then the whistle's your friend. As you said, the whistle's your friend.
What did you think of Connor Schellenberger's performance in this game?
Schellenberger was unbelievable. He turned it on at the end of the year. It's crazy. We got to spend time with his dad and Scott and his mom, Stephanie, over the weekend. They're in a hotel, and Kettering and Kark bumped into him on Thursday and Friday night in our hotel. And what a legend. What a legend.
So we can save that for another podcast that might not get as wide a distribution. But in terms of the redshirt freshman and his ability to turn the corner. I mean, ultimately, it's a skill that, depending on who you talk to, is the most coveted skill in lacrosse. And his ability to do it consistently against top-end defenders is the reason that he was the number one ranked recruit coming out of high school. But he also showed good versatility with his mid-range shooting and his ability to feed and draw a slide and pass through it. Yeah.
Good decisions, great accuracy in his passes. Playing really fast. His hands look great. His fast twitch of his legs. You know, Virginia looked fast this whole tournament. There was other teams that I thought that looked like they would hit their expiration date in terms of their speed. You know, it's been a long year, and you can kind of lose that. He had that. He had explosion. And he was playing loose and free. Matt Moore deserves a shout out.
That's where I was going next.
With the shoulder injury.
Yep.
He played a really, really strong second half, and the two end up going combined eight and four, which is basically they're involved with half of the Virginia goals at least. So Schellenberger, you know, I remember seeing him at the Under Armour games, and I liked him, which, again, it's easy. It's the number one guy. But Johnny Marcus, the former Hopkins goalie who was coaching that Under Armour team, sent me an email late Saturday night or something. He goes, "Oh, you called it. You said Schellenberger was the best guy there." And I don't remember saying that. And that's like, he's like the highest priced stock you could have liked at that point.
Right.
But somewhere, you know, like
sometimes that makes sense to buy Amazon
about that. Yeah, exactly. There's nothing to brag about that. I think the shocker was the whole redshirting last year, which really turned out to be the smartest thing to do. Take the pressure off of them, in the way COVID wiped out the season. It was just a smart move. And Virginia's now loaded going forward with him as their catalyst.
Any other Virginia players that you feel like we haven't mentioned that deserve credit or deserve recognition?
Well, some of the veterans, you know, a guy like Alex Rode now, two-time NCAA champion. The shorties deserve a lot of credit. Petey LaSala, you know, what a year he had. You know, the pictures, that kid is just so tough. The pictures of him just working his stick. You know, Docs Aiken, I thought, played well. And Jeff Connor. Jeff Connor had a nice season. You know, Jeff Connor was a guy, I think, who struggled to shoot in 2020. And he went back to work, and he was a big part of the midfield depth. Bertrand was successful more maybe early in the year, and then he was giving him good minutes and giving him opportunities, and he's a matchup issue. But Connor's and Garneau's, you know, contributions were strong. Xander Dixon was quiet in this tournament, but I thought he looked good towards the end of the year, giving him that different look. You know, being able to invert and. Sean Kerwin deserves a lot of credit. You know, he clearly took the hero ball stuff to heart as he's tweeting about it right now. Hashtag hero ball. But you know, he got this team passing, and then in the finals, he got him actually dodging and scoring an assisted goal. So he continues to do really terrific work in putting his pieces in a place where he can succeed.
From the Maryland lens, obviously, starting with Bernhardt, one of the transcendent seasons in recent college lacrosse memory and cementing a legacy that was already pretty well established as a Maryland great.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, what he did this season and the way he ramped it up in the playoffs, I thought was incredible. You know, I think through the lens of bad Big Ten defenses, there was maybe some skepticism. There was not very many good cover guys in that league, and he had four teams who were in the bottom third of defenses. And so Maryland's putting up these numbers, and you're saying, well, yeah, okay. But they proved it in the tournament. And his timeliness, whether it was Vermont, Notre Dame, domination of Duke, and then in the finals, you know, it'll be interesting to see when the next time he puts on a lacrosse helmet will it be a, you know, for the chaos of the PLL. Soon, or will be down the road. Does he head to Ferris State, or does he walk on at Maryland or somewhere else and play slot receiver instead of quarterback? Still, you know, interesting. It's going to be interesting to see where he ends up and what kind of success he has in football. Does he get into an NFL camp as a you know, as slot receiver? We'll see. You know, this is it's just kind of a shame that Spencer and Bernhardt both haven't been able to immediately pursue pro lacrosse.
Logan Wisnoskis finished the game with 5 goals and an assist. He ends the season with 66 points for the Terrapins.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. 6'3", 215, lefty, Laker, former Orangeman, I am Groot. Man, he had a great game. How about the feel he has to just kind of feel defenses, whether he's working inside or looping around for his left or handling on the wing against a shorty. Does he go underneath? Does he go topside? He's really got a good feel.
It was interesting your comment about the complimentary scoring that Maryland got in this game, because I think that that's true. But I also think that the decision to insert Eric Molliver at attack in place of Daniel Maltz was a reflection of the fact that they felt like they needed more initiating from different points on the field. And it was and post game, John Tillman explicitly talked about how, and I think Lars did as well, you know, Kyle Long got either the game's first or second goal off of dodging a short stick, and then they moved the pole onto him, at which point it really put a lot of the dodging burden on Bubba Fairman, who was effective in his ability to dodge to feed, but his goal came from an off ball play. And his ability to get to the dirt just wasn't there consistently, particularly in the first half.
I mean, I watched Maryland all season long. I had their Hopkins game at Homewood Field, and my questions going into that game was, wait, there's two ways you got to stop Bernhardt, okay? So if you're playing man, he's going to draw doubles, and then you're going to get in the sliding business, and that's what Maryland wants. They have a great passing offense. So are we going to put him out on an island? Maltz, you got a short Maltz, and Kyle Long needs a pull. Whoever's decision it was not to pull Kyle Long needs to watch more tape. I'm sorry. Maryland lacked great dodgers. You know, so much of what they did was dummy dodging to draw doubles to beat you with ball movement. Obviously, Bernhardt's the guy. When he had it, doubles come easy and they're step downs and then ball moving across the top to the far wing. They showed constant patterns where they'll throw it down that left wing to Bernhardt, who's curling righty. Wisnowskis cuts across the formation as Maltz cuts the crease. So their patterns became... you could really see what Bob Benson was getting done. So in my eyes, it was either play man and don't slide much against this group. Beat me off the dodge, somebody not named Bernhardt. And I still don't know who's going to beat me off the dodge 15 times. Or pack it in and play zone and give him the outside shot, because I'm not convinced, other than Eric Holden and maybe Wisnowskis, that they got great outside shooters. I mean, Fairman, DeMeo, and Long do not have outside shots. Maltz does not have an outside shot. Maliver doesn't have an outside shot. So, like, the fact that, you know, Hopkins' defense was man, but it kind of looked like a zone with their splits. They were in so low. They were down at, like, 8 and 9 yards, begging Maryland to take outside shots. So that would have been up my sleeve if I was the defensive coordinator. Those two schemes, either a pack it in zone or a get out and play man-to-man, and we're going to give up all sorts of unassisted goals because we don't think he can run by us consistently.
One other guy I want to mention, Roman Pugliese, a, you know, just stalwart at the defensive midfield for the Terrapins, and he had a goal in each of the championship weekend games for the Terps.
Yeah, you know, I got to go back and watch this tape again and kind of look at it more from a defensive viewpoint. It was an interesting game to announce because after being at home much of the year, after, you know, doing shows that were, you know, kind of basic shows, this show had our cameras, our Skycam, our Supermo, our audio. It was just like, just shut up and let this game play out. You know, don't say something that will detract from the incredible action. Roman was good. You know, this, I got a lot of respect for this kid. He's done it in the classroom and on the field. Big Ten Medal of Honor, really mature mindset. He's kept improving. He's emblematic of Maryland's culture. I give him a lot of credit. Loves his mom, Stella. She, you know, as Kark said, she handles his laundry. She's got the best chicken parm in Virginia. He plays for his... Yeah, he plays for Gus Lee, you know, his friend from high school. This kid is everything that's great about college lacrosse. And you think about Maryland's culture, it's guys like Roman.
Let's quickly talk about the games on Saturday. Obviously, Maryland and Virginia emerged as victors in order to advance to the title game. In the first game, the Cavaliers continued their cardiac streak by virtue of beating North Carolina by one goal. You know, it was a similar type of game of runs in this respect, and Virginia emerged 12-11 victors over the Tar Heels. Schellenberger, once again, the player of the game with 2 goals and 4 assists, Peyton Cormier, 3 goals, Charlie Bertrand, 2, and then a host of Cavaliers with 1 goal. William Perry, the... Sub-Zero, is that his nickname? That was an incredible performance. He was so hot down the stretch that it felt like if he was going to let loose a shot, he was going to tie the game. He finished with 5 goals. Chris Gray had 3 and 2.
Yeah, the difference in goaltending was dramatic in this game. I thought this game was won in the second quarter with the 6-goal run.
Yep.
Virginia trailing 4-3. Next thing you know, they go up 9-4. They kind of trade or match goals. They finish the third quarter with 2 in a row, Cormier and Laviano, and then they hold on. They didn't score in the fourth quarter, which is kind of rare to win a high-level game and not score, but they did enough and held on. At the end of the day, I think you got the four Final Four teams. Notre Dame would have to be fifth or fourth best if you think, you know, they probably played better than Duke late in the year. And then I'd go Rutgers at six. Like, if I'm doing my end of year rankings, you know, Virginia 1, Maryland 2, Notre Dame 3, Carolina 4, or K Carolina 3, Notre Dame 4, Duke 5 or 6 with Rutgers.
Maryland 14, Duke 5 in the second semifinal. Just one of the more dominating performances we've seen against a Duke team in recent memory. Jared Bernhardt, 5 goals and 2 assists, just looked like they couldn't match feet with him. And at the other end of the field, it really felt like, you know, Duke's offense was just put in a box by Maryland's defenders. And, you know, my comment was just try to remember a Duke Dodger that dodged hard twice in the second half, meaning that, you know, everybody kind of gave it a go and got turned back. And that was the point at which it was just like, all right, I'm not going to be able to win this matchup. And a lot of, you know, go try to get to 10 yards, roll back, move the ball. And that is the hallmark of a defense that's just kind of won a game, even if there's still 10 or 15 minutes left on the clock.
I could do a 2-hour podcast about Duke this season, Terry. Just one of the most interesting studies in team chemistry, roster development, player utilization, scheme based on what we do as opposed to our players' strengths, ebb and flows of winning by a little when not playing well and taking that as fool's gold, and ultimately then that catching up to you. I thought their game plan against Maryland was stale. Clearly at 3-2 and 4-2 when Bernhardt scored from Fairman, like, this game was getting away from Duke. They did nothing to impact change in the game. They just kind of stayed with what wasn't working. I got kind of shaking my head. This was a dreadful ending to Duke's season. Dreadful, dreadful. And their personnel decisions, there's just like every week they're just reintroducing somebody to the mix. Oh, there's Riley Walsh. We haven't seen him in 4 weeks. Oh, now subbing in on defense for JT Giles Harris, Frank Marinella. Like really? Wilson Stevenson, yeah, we know his story, but like a couple weeks ago, Rain Schamberger started, and now we're seeing Marinello and the midfielders. You know, like Quigley got a lot of run the
other day. A lot of Quigley and a lot of Ledman,
Basile, and like I, you know, at the end of the day, I you know, they never turned the keys over to Sowers. They never ran a Mike Sowers centric offense, and you know, in hindsight, we were talking about it the other night. I'm like, look, I put Sowers behind the net. I put Phil Robertson and Joe Robertson inside with Dyson and have those three guys run some spaghetti. I put O'Neal on a wing as a shooter, as a step-down guy. He'll curl across the formation. He'll catch it with an approach and be able to dodge. And I put Nakai on the other wing. And I just let those guys freelance and play. It was so structured. All season, Sowers would go to the goal, and the cuts were not timed up. Turn back the Princeton tapes. I mean, that's a team that lived off of Sowers at X, making a move, throwing the ball to the back post to Phil Robertson, goal, layup, throwing the ball to a step down McCarthy, like really simple stuff. And Sowers is not a great skip passer. He's not a great through passer, but he can beat his guy, draw doubles, and there's going to be a numbers game on the inside, and he can jam the ball inside accurately. I just didn't ever see this offense maximizing Michael Sowers.
Championship weekend in East Hartford, Connecticut at Rentschler Field in the shadow of a Pratt & Whitney airplane engine manufacturing facility with an airfield behind it.
Yeah. Really windy. It's really windy there in the fall when you cover football there. Okay. I like the venue. I got no problems with the venue. I think it's pretty good. There's not many bad seats. When we go to NFL stadiums, we got a whole upper deck of bad seats. This place doesn't have bad seats. The tailgating is terrific. The traffic management leaving that place is dreadful. It's horrible. It's substandard. I don't know what they're thinking. There's 13,000 people there, and it took 25 minutes to get out of the parking lot. Okay, I missed my flight. I had to drive to Providence, so I'm a little bitter there. The town, there's no epicenter for fans. It's not a great downtown. I mean, obviously, this pandemic and a lot of places, restaurants and stuff are closed. So it lacks in that department. So I love the field. I love the surface. I like the arena. I like the you know, the folks there from Fairfield and the organizing committee treated us terrifically, but I don't know. If we're going to go to college campuses, why aren't we at Rutgers where more people can drive to the game easily?
Well, and why aren't we at a college campus? First of all, it's not a college campus. And second of all, that has a men's lacrosse team.
Yeah, and Hartford, if you think of Hartford, like, okay, that's up in New England. It's in, Hartford's kind of far from a lot of places.
Yeah.
Hartford is like 2 hours from Albany, 2 hours from Boston, at least hour and a half from Providence, like Westchester County, Long Island, far, Maryland, forever. Ugh, I know Rutgers, as a kid, I drove there for the 83 finals with my brother and his teammates.
Did you see Lars? He was there. That was the day he fell in love with lacrosse.
I may have sat next to Lars at that game. I was there wearing my number 2 Limburg High School jersey, rooting for Syracuse, thinking that these Hopkins fans and their band are the most obnoxious. We want more. Oh, shut up.
Oh, mercy. The opening up the aperture on the whole season a little bit more. We'll come back with a little bit more time to have digested and reflected on what the last 4 months held in store for us or delivered to us.
Yeah, I got one quiz for our fans. Memorial Day, special day. I liked Coach Tiffany's comments. Lacrosse and Memorial Day are super tied together. Terry, I think IL ran an article a couple years ago about some of these awards that are given out in lacrosse.
Yep.
The Anson C. Markland Kelly Award for the outstanding goalie. Okay. Do folks know who Markland Kelly was? He played at Maryland in 1940. He was a pilot in the Navy. He died in the Battle of Midway in 1942. Okay. Don McLaughlin, Defender of the Year. Or excuse me, McLaughlin goes to the Midfielder of the Year. Do you know who McLaughlin was, Terry?
I do not. I believe he died in Vietnam.
Don McLaughlin grew up in Catonsville, 10 miles outside of Baltimore, on a farm. 10 miles from downtown Baltimore in Catonsville. Went to the Naval Academy. Believe he graduated in the early 60s. He died in Vietnam. Ray Enners. Did Bernhardt win the Enners this year?
Yes, he did.
Okay. The Enners Award is named after who? Well, it's named after Ray Enners, who played at Army. Great player. He died in Vietnam, 1968. What's the Turnbull Trophy for?
Jack Turnbull Trophy is for the Attackman of the Year.
World War II hero, Johns Hopkins, 3- or 4-time All-American, one of the best of his era by far, well-regarded as the best player ever to play until the 60s, and Jimmy Lewis and Jim Brown and those guys. Jack Turnbull died in World War II in 1944. So the tie-ins to Memorial Day and just Google these names, people. Google these names because I think we've gotten away from tying in this history. Army, Navy were always relevant in college lacrosse, and there's just this incredible history and tie-in between college lacrosse and Memorial Day. Not to mention Jimmy Regan or Brendan Looney.
Of course. Well, with that, Quint, we will end this quick restart. As always, we thank you for your time and insight. Congratulations on executing a pandemic season in 2021.
Yeah, we made it. And I got to tell you, the fans who listen, thank you. We are whistle ready at the Quick Restart Podcast. Whistle ready.